Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. I'm pleased to announce that we have a bar admission today. At this time, the court recognizes Mr. Justin Lascalzo for a motion.
May it please the court. I move the admission of Robert Mathai of the bars of the District of Columbia and the State of Maryland. I have examined his credentials on file in the office of the clerk, and I am satisfied he possesses the qualifications for membership in the bar of the court.
Thank you, Mr. Lascalzo. Mr. Mathai, my colleagues and I have conferred, and we have become convinced of your integrity and your legal acumen. Accordingly, we have voted unanimously to admit you to the bar of this court. Therefore, Mr. Lascalzo, your motion is granted. Mr. Squires, please administer the oath. Mr. Mathai, I'd like to welcome you to the bar of the court. In doing so, I think it's appropriate for me to recite the words that are engraved over the entrance to the University of Virginia School of Law. That's because both you and I went to UVA Law, and Judge Johnson received her LLM from UVA Law. Those aspirational words are as follows: that those alone may be servants of the law who labor with learning, courage, and devotion to preserve liberty and promote justice. Because this court is convinced that you indeed exemplify those ideals, it's a pleasure to invite you, to admit you as a member of the bar of the court. And we're pleased that your family members could be here for this event. So congratulations, you may be seated. Mr. Squires, do we have any other business before the court before we turn to oral argument? Very well. Then we will proceed to oral argument, the case of United States versus Wheeler. Lieutenant Commander Marinos, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Colonel Jennings, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Commander Megan Marinos, and I represent Petty Officer Wheeler. Chief Judge Olson, I respectfully request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. Petty Officer Wheeler wanted, requested, and deserved a fair trial. But when he refused nonjudicial punishment and demanded trial by court-martial, he was forced into a mandatory bench trial, stripping him of his fundamental due process right of a multi-member panel. And because the government secured Petty Officer Wheeler's conviction without the protection of a panel, this court should set aside the findings and sentence. Three reasons support this conclusion. First, service members have been afforded the right to a multi-member panel at criminal proceedings for nearly 250 years. Second, there are no reasonable alternative safeguards currently in place in the military justice system that afford the same protections as a multi-member panel. And third, any efficiency created by this forum is outweighed by the threat to a fair and reliable conviction.
Counsel, if I may, I'd like to direct your attention to 1999 case of United States versus Gammons that was decided by this court. Now, my intent is not to blindside you. This case was neither cited by you nor by the government. But there's language in there that really caught my attention, and so I'd like to pass it by you. This court said in that case that three things that I think are I'd like to discuss with you. It said, there's no precise formula for determining whether an offense is minor or serious. Stated that the decision whether an offense is minor is a matter of discretion for the commander, and that, quote, commanders are permitted to treat nominally serious offenses as minor. So under that precedent, If a commander decides that a nominally serious offense that carries a penalty of 2 years imprisonment should in fact be treated as a minor offense, sent to a judge-alone trial, why isn't that discretionary determination by the commander something that's controlling in terms of our decision in this case?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court emphasized in Baldwin, Blanton, and Lewis this necessity of an objective standard when determining whether or not an offense in those circumstances are serious or petty. When Congress created this new forum in the military justice working group notes, we see that they did it in order to create a system similar to the civilian system. They say repeatedly that this was in attempting to be in line with the system in existence in federal civilian courts, the petty courts. So in doing so, the objective standard necessary for determining what is serious or what is minor in the military, there needs to now be an objective standard, rather. While one may not have existed in, I believe you said the case was heard in 1991, Your
Honor.
While the necessity for an objective standard may not have existed at that time because we did not have this mandatory bench trial that is meant to be similar to the civilian system, this new forum has made it so that there must be some objectivity when determining when an individual is stripped of a fundamental due process right, particularly here, the right to a multi-member panel, which the interest at stake is the reliability and trustworthiness of a conviction. So while a convening authority is certainly still able to determine whether an offense goes to a general or special court-martial, which is truly the distinction between, which is one other distinction between serious and minor in the military justice system, the creation of this new forum and the deprivation of a fundamental right essentially moots the Gammon analysis, or rather it does not apply it to this new forum.
Well, counsel, do you, would you agree that it's Congress's role as the legislature to balance that, to balance the rights of an accused in our system against good order and discipline and efficiency and effectiveness within the system?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And would you agree then that in this context, in creating this judge-alone forum, that Congress did that balancing?
Congress attempted, Your Honor, to do a balancing test, but the balance they struck was insufficient. Efficiencies cited do not outweigh the factors militating in favor of a service member's right to to a multi-member panel. And that balancing test comes from Mittendorf versus Henry. Mm-hmm. And when addressing that balance, both this court in Anderson and the Supreme Court in Weiss have walked through certain factors to determine whether or not an appropriate balance was struck. Looking to the historical maintenance of a particular right, alternative safeguards already within the system that afford protections for the same interest that's at stake, as well as any efficiencies created or not created by the particular change in procedural process being afforded. So when we look at history, and we can walk through both Weiss and Anderson to really understand how, for the reasons Weiss and Anderson failed, Petty Officer Wheeler prevails. And first, looking at history, in both Weiss and Anderson, the courts determined that history cut against the petitioner in both cases, the appellant in both cases. Because in Weiss, we had never been afforded there had never been tenured judges in the military justice system. Military judges did not exist until 1968, but since that time, there had been no fixed terms or tenure. So the fact that there was no historical maintenance of that right cut against the appellant in that case. In Anderson, similarly, unanimous verdicts have never been afforded in the military justice system. So that element, again, cuts against Anderson in that case. But here, we have panels of members being afforded to service members since the creation of the military justice system since 1775. So that's
yes, but aren't there examples wherein that they were not afforded, that Congress made a decision, or delegated the authority to the appropriate authorities to make the decision to withhold that the right to a panel?
Yes, Your Honor. The particular panels throughout history, so in the field officers court-martial, which is cited by the government, that is essentially the predecessor, and it's actually acknowledged by the government to be the predecessor to the summary court-martial. But a summary court-martial, we know, is not a criminal proceeding. Mm-hmm. It was not then, and it is not now. And an individual has the right to refuse that particular forum now. So to compare, when we speak specifically about the historical right of a multi-member panel, we are speaking of the historical right afforded at criminal proceedings, not at non-criminal proceedings, understanding that in Mittendorf v. Henry, it was solidified that summary courts martial are non-criminal proceedings, and certain procedural rights may be deprived at those proceedings. However, the safeguard afforded of the ability to refuse that forum is what makes it an appropriate balance in Mittendorf versus Henry, which brings us to the second element essentially reviewed typically by, or second factor reviewed by the courts when addressing the Mittendorf balancing test, these alternative safeguards. And what needs to be clear is when an alternative safeguard is defined, it's not simply additional protections being afforded. And that's where the lower court failed. They kept highlighting, oh, but this new forum gives additional statutory protections to the Kaplan, with the Kaplan confinement. But a protection is not the same as safeguarding a very specific interest that's at stake. And here the interest at stake is Petty Officer Wheeler's right to a reliable, trustworthy panel.
Counsel, may I ask you about that? And you emphasize that same point on page 15 where you say that if you only have one person deciding, they may have latent biases or limits in interpreting the evidence. But in this case, your client not only had the military judge, but didn't they also have a factual sufficiency review and a sentence appropriateness review by the CCA? So your client actually had four officers look at the sufficiency of the evidence and the appropriateness of the sentence.
No, Your Honor, because in this particular case, Petty Officer Wheeler was not afforded appellate review under Article 66.
Well, it's true. It's true that not other people may not be afforded that review under Article 66, but he got review under 69, and in the last paragraph of the opinion, they conducted a factual sufficiency review. Was that an error for them to do that?
Your Honor, it's at the court's discretion, though it arguably does run in violation of the fact that Article 69 and 66 are separate, and when a case comes through Article 69, there is no automatic requirement, essentially, for the court to do review, so not necessarily an error, but not a requirement.
But in your case, your client did get this review.
Yes. Petty Officer Wheeler did receive review based off of the court's saying they conducted the review, not based off of the review that he was due, Your Honor.
And going forward under the NDA 2022, anybody who has been convicted of an offense will have an Article 66 review of factual sufficiency.
Yes, Your Honor, but factual sufficiency has changed in that it used to be that factual sufficiency, again, was automatically conducted by the CCAs under Article 66. Now an accused has the responsibility to raise some deficiency in order to trigger that review. So it's essentially a shift of burden, which is why it's not a reasonable alternative safeguard here. Three judges sitting on a CCA who you need to demonstrate that there was some deficiency in your court-martial, in your proceedings below, in order for them to even review for factual sufficiency, makes it, as the Navy Marine Corps court said in Harvey, essentially a presumption of guilt, not a presumption of innocence. Whereas at the trial level, when he should have been afforded a panel of members, there would have been a presumption of innocence, and the government would have had to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. And then those members conducted the very unique deliberative process that members do, where they need to debate the evidence and come to, and obviously not a unanimous verdict in our system, but will have to vote after reviewing the evidence, debating the evidence, and ensuring any latent biases are alleviated. That is not something that is afforded when three judges on a CCA conduct a factual sufficiency review. It's not the same unique proceeding. And as the Supreme Court explained in Ballou, while not implemented into our system, by looking at a variety of studies, anytime you reduce the number of fact finders responsible for coming to a conclusion, the reliability of that ultimate conclusion, here a criminal conviction, is weakened.
May I ask you on that point as well? I mean, aren't we going to look a little silly saying that a trial by a military judge alone is unfair and unreliable when the vast majority of our trials are by military judge alone? I mean, it just seems contrary to all experience.
Your Honor, it's not that a trial by military judge alone is unreliable. It's that it's less reliable. And that's why an individual up until 2019 had to waive his or her right to a multi-member panel. This was an affirmative waiver on the record where the military judge explained that this was the right they were afforded and they could choose the right to a military judge alone. And there could be strategic reasons for why an accused makes that decision, but that choice is with the accused. And we see this discussion of choice in Mittendorf v. Henry, where individuals and criminal proceedings, whether it be civil or military, or civilian or military, are faced with the challenge of perhaps electing a certain benefit afforded in one area, but foregoing a process right in another. So in Mittendorf v. Henry, it was a summary court martial where individuals could, receive a punishment cap. It wouldn't be a criminal conviction. However, they had the option. They would be deprived of the right to a defense counsel. But they had the option to opt out of that particular forum and elect to receive their due process rights, but at the expense of these nice confinement or these caps on penalties and now being exposed to a criminal conviction. But these complicated decisions that need to be made are the decisions of the accused, not Congress.
But counsel, aren't those rights tied to the maximum penalty, right? Here, the appellant's not exposed to any more than 6 months of confinement, right? So why does he have a right to a panel if his maximum exposure, according to Congress, is only 6 months in this forum?
Because, Your Honor, the statutory cap on the forum is, first, not a sufficient alternative safeguard for the interest at stake.
What? I mean, isn't the interest defined by the maximum punishment? Like, isn't that how we've defined whether you get a jury or a panel or you don't?
It's defined by the maximum punishment assigned to the offense, not to the forum in which an offense is disposed.
Right. So the president, in an executive order, has said for this offense you could possibly, if you were in front of a panel, you could get more. But why can't, that's an executive order, why can't Congress in a statute come in and override that and say, well, actually, there's two versions of this offense. One, which you can get more than 6 months if you go before a panel, and another, where you can only get 6 months if you go before a military judge alone.
Your Honor, this now results in a very subjective standard for how serious offenses will be disposed of. And as we see in Blanton, Baldwin, and Lewis, objectivity is critical here when determining what is serious and what is petty. So this subjective, up to essentially the whim of a convening authority, once we trickle all the way down.
Well, what if the president in the manual took the offenses and created serious and petty versions with the same elements, right? We've all accepted that the president can create sub-offenses underneath the statutory offenses for each of the articles. So what if the president takes an offense and creates a serious version that has, you know, a year maximum confinement, and then says there's also a petty version of this offense which has nearly identical elements, and it only has 6 months. And if you get charged with the petty version, you can go before a military judge alone. Like, would that would seem to resolve your argument about it being objective, but it wouldn't really change practically. Nothing would be different.
Your Honor, what would be different in those circumstances is at least there would be some objectivity. And given your hypothetical, it sounded as if the offenses would be similar but not necessarily identical.
Well, let's just say they're identical. They just have different.
Well, then this is, I guess, no different than if the president, I suppose, Your Honor, went right into the maximum punishments and just reduced them to the existing offenses to 6 months. He could do that. And that would at least create this objective standard. I see my time is about to expire.
Please continue answering.
And while he has the authority to do that, and he could, that's not what happened. Instead, we have, I think it's important to start with the lack of boundaries placed on this forum in Articles 16 and 19, in that non-capital murder, based off the plain language of the statute, can be forced into a mandatory bench trial. I don't know that anyone would argue that that level of severity, that serious of an offense, should be forced into a mandatory bench trial and strip an individual of his right to a multi-member panel. And that's why this objectivity is so critical, and forcing the president to determine maximum punishments that are, or excuse me, Your Honor, what the president is considering when he sets maximum punishments is supposed to be how society, what society believes is the, essentially reflects what society believes the severity of the sentence is, which is why it's so useful to rely on that standard as opposed to the subjective standard of, in one circumstance it will be 2 years, in one circumstance it will be 5 years. But to rely on the pure whim of a convening authority, that one individual who commits this one crime on one day can go to a bench trial, and one individual who commits an identical crime on the next day can go to a general court-martial and be afforded all of his due process rights, creates this, it would be detrimental to this fair trial or fair and reliable conviction that is at stake for both individuals.
Thank you, counsel. Further questions from the bench? Thank you, Lieutenant Commander Marinos. Colonel Jennings.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Colonel Joseph Jennings, representing the United States along with Mr. Brian Kelly. This court should affirm because the Sixth Amendment jury clause does not apply to the military, and the due process right asserted by appellant here is not so extraordinarily weighty as to overcome the balance struck by Congress. Regarding the inapplicability of the Sixth Amendment, we'd like to rely on our brief and on this court's recent opinion in Anderson and move directly to the Fifth Amendment issue. I'd like to make 3 points before getting to the Middendorf-Weiss analysis. First, appellant's argument relies on the notion that maximum punishment associated with the offense is the only acceptable way to determine whether a jury is necessary. But that's not true even in the civilian world when the Sixth Amendment jury clause applies. In Noctegal, the maximum punishment was set by an executive actor in accordance with a legislative cap, and the Supreme Court found that acceptable. And in a line of cases dealing with criminal contempt, specifically Bloom v. Illinois, Frank v. United States, the Supreme Court found it acceptable to look at the punishment actually imposed. And that was because Congress, in recognition of the scope of criminal contempt cases, chose not to assign a maximum punishment or to designate certain contempt offenses as either serious or petty. So if this is acceptable in the civilian world, where the Sixth Amendment jury clause does apply, it must also pass muster for the military, especially given the fact that the Make Rules Clause gives Congress plenary authority. Second point, there can be no due process concerns here because the military framework actually provides greater panel rights than the jury rights that civilians receive. Article 19B provides a hard 6-month cap. There is no possibility, no matter how many offenses a service member is convicted of at a mandatory bench trial, there is no possibility of that service member either receiving a punitive discharge or more than 6 months. And that's not true in the civilian world, as the Supreme Court tells us in Lewis v. United States. Civilians can receive more than 6 months in jail without a jury if they are convicted of 2 or more petty offenses.
But, counsel, can't that just be overcome by having multiple trials?
I suppose it could, Your Honor. The manual also instructs convening authorities to combine offenses for the sake of military efficiency. But it's a fair point, Your Honor.
What about appellant counsel's argument that this really goes to the issue of the fundamental fairness of a trial, due process rights, particularly focusing on the reliability and trustworthiness of the determinations? What is the government's response to that?
Jury rights are important, but they are not absolute, even for civilians who enjoy the protections of the Sixth Amendment Jury Clause. And Duncan v. Louisiana tells us that very specifically. Duncan rejects the notion that bench trials can never be as fair or reliable as jury trials. Duncan also points to centuries of history, dating back to the time of Blackstone, and points out that that bench trials were well known to the framers. Furthermore, Duncan says specifically, and its progeny then spell this out in further detail, that when 6 months is the maximum punishment that is available, that the jury right, while important, is outweighed by the government's interest in efficient non-jury adjudications. So even for civilians, that jury right is not absolute.
But what about the argument that in the civilian world, some legislative body has made a determination that the maximum punishment can be 6 months, and therefore it is a petty offense, a minor offense. But here, you can have offenses that are nominally serious, it can go up to 2 years, and bam, that's what they're going to be convicted of. That's what they're going to have on their record, is that they were convicted of this offense that was serious. What about that argument?
Well, I think that really gets to the heart of the matter, and as Judge Hardy alluded to with his questions to my colleague, what appellant is really asserting here is not the right to a jury trial, because this military framework places the service member on equal footing with his civilian counterpart. What appellant is really asserting here is the right to have that 6-month confinement cap provided in a specific way, through a specific mechanism. In other words, the legislative determination that is associated with the offense itself. And so when we get to the Middendorf-Weiss analysis, that is really what we are weighing here. Is that right to have that 6-month protection provided in a specific way so extraordinarily weighty as to overcome Congress's plenary authority?
But that kind of goes to the point I'm raising, where if a legislative body decides that the maximum penalty is 6 months, it is theoretically understood that that is, from society's viewpoint, as their elected representatives, that offense is minor. But here you can have offenses that Congress previously had determined could receive as much as 2 years in prison. If the service member has that conviction for that offense on their record, why isn't that of concern?
Right. I think what Your Honor is referring to is essentially there is a risk associated with this military framework that someone in the outside world, say a future employer, might misperceive the seriousness of the offense. They might, for example, see the criminal record of someone applying for a job, and then might go look it up in the manual for court-martial and see that this offense is punishable by up to 2 years. So again, defining that right, there would mean that the appellant is asserting that they have a right to be free of any risk of such misperception. Is that right so extraordinarily weighty as to overcome the balance struck by Congress? The answer is no. I don't think we need to look farther than Blanton itself. In Blanton, the Supreme Court acknowledged that any amount of jail time can carry quite serious repercussions for career and reputation. And yet, when the punishment being faced is less than 6 months, that jury right is still outweighed by the government's interest in efficient non-jury adjudications.
So, counsel, on the point of efficient non-jury adjudications, we've had panels for 250 years, and all of a sudden now we need to not have panels. Seems like a kind of weak argument, this efficiency. How many special Judge Alone special cases are being referred to Judge Alone special courts martial?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, I don't have any data on that, and there certainly is none in the record.
And so we sort of have to balance the government's interest in efficiency against the decrease in fairness and reliability without any knowledge of what's on either side of the scale.
Well, that's right. I mean, first of all, I would point out that it's appellant's burden, his heavy burden, to show that a congressional action is unconstitutional. I would also point to the fact that, again, in Duncan v. Louisiana, the Supreme Court acknowledges that mandatory bench trials increase the efficiency of the civilian justice system, and we can think of no reason why that wouldn't also be true in the military. And again, referring to the history, if you look at the history of summary court-martials and field officer courts, what you see is that Congress has frequently decided that more efficient adjudications are necessary. This is simply the next step in that evolutionary process. And finally, of course, Congress gets deference here. And if we require Congress to prove with data that its actions will make the military justice more efficient, then that would be the opposite of the deference that they are entitled to.
Counsel, building on Judge Magus's question, I think that the appellant makes a fairly convincing case that, and you may disagree, but let's say I'm convinced that this is a little farther than Congress has ever gone before in taking, you know, the right to a panel away from service members. Why shouldn't that give us a little pause?
I don't think we need to look any farther than the centuries of history of mandatory bench trials, both in England and in the United States. We know that that which in substance is immemorially the actual law of the land is due process. And mandatory bench trials have been the actual law of the land for centuries. I'd like to make one more point, that there is no need for the military to draw the distinction between serious and petty in the same place as the civilian world. As a matter of fact, there's really no need for the military to draw that line at all. Starting in 1888 with Callan v. Wilson, the Supreme Court had to confront the fact that there is a direct conflict between what the Sixth Amendment says about any criminal prosecutions and what the courts in the United States had been doing for almost 100 years by that point. So the Supreme Court had to resolve that, and in the following cases, it did so by first creating a distinction between serious and petty offenses, and then drawing a reasonably bright line between them at 6 months. Congress also did its part by passing statutes, first 18 U.S.C. Section 1, and then its successor, 18 U.S.C. Section 19, which is still in effect today, that specifically defined petty offenses for purposes of the federal system. By contrast, in the military, the Sixth Amendment Jury Clause does not apply. So you have no constitutional conflict to resolve. And that is why there has never been a distinction in the military between serious and petty offenses. And that's why Articles 16 and 19 don't draw that line. Neither Article 16, Article 19, nor RCM 201 say anything about serious offenses or petty offenses or minor offenses. They don't have to. They don't need to draw that line in this context.
So under that argument, would a non-capital murder offense be triable judge alone?
It could be
imposed on an accused judge alone.
Well, if the president, for example, were to lift any restrictions on the jurisdiction of the of that court-martial forum, that would be a much more difficult argument for the government to
But make. You seem to be making yes. that argument.
We think the argument is yes. There is clearly nothing in the Constitution or the common law that states explicitly that Congress could not do that. The Make Rules Clause gives Congress plenary authority and puts judicial deference at its apogee. The Sixth Amendment Jury Clause does not apply. And there is also a long history of the military not applying panel rights in the same way as the civilians apply jury rights. And my colleague referred to some of those. Ballou versus Georgia says that a jury has to have at least six members. That rule has never applied in the military. Unanimous verdicts have to be reached in civilian cases. That rule has never applied in the military as well. So we don't see anything, again, in either the Constitution or the common law that says that Congress specifically could not do that, even in the unlikely event of the president lifting all such restrictions. Going back to the Mindorf-Weiss analysis, we've already talked about how to define that offense or define the right that is being asserted by appellant. to be provided a six-month cap in a specific way, and also, as Chief Judge Olson mentioned, perhaps the right to be free of any risk of misperception. So when we actually weigh those rights, performing the Nimdorf-Weiss analysis, we ask whether they're so extraordinarily weighty as to overcome the balance struck by Congress. And here the answer is no. The interest of the government in efficient non-jury adjudications is strong. It's the same interest in efficiency that Nimdorf gave substantial weight to. Here we also have the other safeguards, in effect, that Weiss found were important. We have a qualified and independent judiciary that is protected against unlawful command influence. Weiss specifically points to that. We have a far more robust appellate system than the civilians enjoy. And although factual sufficiency may have changed recently, it is certainly more review than civilians receive. We have rights to defense counsel to an extent that is unheard of in the civilian world. And lastly, as I mentioned already, service members facing a mandatory bench trial have a hard, absolute six-month cap that civilians do not enjoy. And finally, we feel that history weighs strongly against appellant's claim. Since 1775, commanders have frequently been authorized to punish offenses without resort to multi-member panels. Even if we adopt appellant's preferred view of history, and we ignore the summary courts martial and field officers' courts, the result wouldn't change. Because again, as Duncan points out, mandatory bench trials were common at the time of Blackstone. They were well known to the framers. So until 2019, this history played out only in the civilian courts. But again, we can reason by comparison here. If mandatory bench trials are acceptable, we know they are, for civilians who enjoy Sixth Amendment jury clause protections, then they must be acceptable for military service members who do not enjoy that protection.
What precisely are the efficiencies that are being introduced through this new court-martial procedure?
Well, I mean, the most obvious one is the fact that the command does not need to provide members for the court-martial. And the Supreme Court has noted that the purpose of the military is to fight wars. And when service members are taken away from those duties in order to attend to matters of military justice, that the purpose of the military is not being served. So I think that's the most obvious one, is that the members don't have to be provided with, the commander is not forced to take a certain number of members away from their duties for a specific period of time.
What about the idea that it may be faster to have a military judge alone trial? Is that part of the equation or is that off the table?
I believe it is faster. Again, I don't have any data to prove that, but that certainly is part of the consideration. Obviously, when you're trying a case in front of members, there are certain complications that wouldn't arise in front of a judge alone. For example, the need to litigate issues, motions in limine far ahead of time so that the parties have a solid understanding of what evidence can be presented to the members. You don't want to have to worry about trying to unring a bell.
So in any instance such as this, if Congress cites efficiency, which is so amorphous, and there are no benchmarks by which a court can judge that, are we supposed to just say Congress gets to decide, this court needs to step aside?
In a word, yes, Your Honor. I think that's the clear takeaway from Rosker, in which case the Supreme Court was dealing with multiple sets of data, one of which suggested that extending the draft to women would be better for the military.
So there is no check on the legislative branch's authority when it comes to ensuring the due process rights of our service members?
There is a check. The Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause is the check.
But in terms of this court really enforcing that right, if you're saying when it comes to Congress citing something as amorphous as efficiency, we can't get behind that, we can't judge that, we can't gauge that, Where does this leave us in terms of checks and balances?
The concern I think that Your Honor has really extends to one part of the Middendorf-Weiss analysis, which is the effect of providing the procedure that appellant is asking for. So to that extent, when Congress, as in Middendorf, says we believe that it is more efficient to not provide defense counsel a summary court-martial, the Supreme Court in Middendorf doesn't turn to Congress and say, well, prove it. Where's your data that says this is more efficient? The Supreme Court instead finds that it would, in fact, turn a brief proceeding into something that is more attenuated. But even then, the other factors of the Middendorf-Weiss analysis would be independently reviewed by this court, and I don't think that deference to the congressional finding would extend to those. Finally, I'd like to quickly address the notion that it violates the Constitution to allow the convening authority to decide what forum to send a case to because it could result in non-uniform or unfair outcomes. 2 points to make there. The first is that there is always discretion in any prosecution exercised by some actor. In the civilian world, a prosecutor or a judge. In the military, a convening authority. And we know that this does not offend due process because in the contempt line of cases, the Supreme Court held that it was acceptable for a judge by himself or herself to decide whether the contempt offenses were serious or petty and therefore whether they merited a jury. And there's also extensive precedent, Brown v. Glines, for example, in which the Supreme Court has said that it is appropriate, necessary, to provide convening authorities that discretion over matters of internal discipline. In conclusion, I ask the Court to affirm.
Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Colonel Jennings. Lieutenant Commander Marinos.
Your Honors, the government just discussed how judicial deference owed Congress is at its apogee when Congress is creating rules for the regulation of government of the armed forces. But deference owed Congress is not absolute. And simply because Congress states some reason for its change or deprivation of a particular procedural right does not mean that it overcomes the balancing test afforded in Middendorf v. Henry. I think it's important to come back to the safeguards here, or rather the lack of safeguards. The interest at issue is reliable, trustworthy convictions. The government is pointing to the fact that a service member has added protections when brought to this new forum. There's a cap on the penalty. But this is the equivalent of an individual who has a home without a front door. So they repoint the walls, refinish the floors, and replace the roof. They still don't have a front door. Here, while Congress may have given an individual a benefit if they are in this particular mandatory bench trial, the benefit of a 6-month cap on confinement, no punitive discharge, that does nothing to address the interest of a fair, reliable criminal conviction. And without that safeguard, in combination with the historical maintenance of a multi-member panel, any efficiency, minor efficiency that we're seeing be created through this new panel is far outweighed by the interests at stake and the protections afforded by a multi-member panel. And in light of the nearly 250 years of historical maintenance and lack of sufficient alternative safeguards, we hold that the factors militating, this court should hold that the factors militating in favor of multi-member panels for service members charged with offenses carrying a maximum punishment of more than 6 months confinement are so extraordinarily weighty as to overcome the balance struck by Congress in Articles 16 and 19 and the President in RCM 201. Barring any further questions from the bench.
Any questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise. The court is adjourned until further order of the court.